we're learning about the work of violence interrupters on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They go into hot spots for violent crime, talk with neighbors, connect people directly with resources to help solve problems and make vulnerable communities safer. Cities hope that violence interruption will build trust and de-escalate situations before they become deadly. But violent crime continues to worsen. No signs of letting up in cities around the country. Has your family been touched by gun violence? What do you want to say? What questions do you have about violence intervention tactics? 800-642-1234. Teo Hardiman is executive director of the nonprofit called Violence Interrupters, based in the Chicago area, and training community to mediate conflicts before it's too late. Teo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, it's an honor to be on the show with you this morning.
Good morning. Tell us about your work and about what Violence Interrupters is trying to do.
Yes, well, I created the Violence Interrupter Initiative back in 2004. And what the Violence Interrupters are attempting to do and what we've done is we mediate conflicts on the front end because we have boots on the ground and we have credible messengers that can intercept whispers on the street level in order to stop and detect a potential conflict on the front end, and then we mediate the conflict. And once the conflict has been mediated and everybody's okay, no one has been shot or killed, no one has to go to the penitentiary or whatever, or the cemetery, then we connect the young people to social services such as, you know, some mental health services, drug treatment services, or in some cases, we re-enroll young men back into school and young women. And then we also help people secure employment, you know, in some cases, but most importantly, what Violence Interrupters do is we work with young people to change their mindset because it's hard to take young people out of the circumstances they're living in. So we work to change the way they think because a lot of young people have been conditioned to think that violence is the norm and it's okay to shoot or hurt somebody. That's what we do pretty much. That's my elevator pitch to you and your audience there in regards to what we do.
Part of that elevator pitch I would add is, you know, you're walking and you're talking, you know, you're seeing eye to eye with residents in a neighborhood. What impact does that make?
Well, it makes a major impact because it's about building trust, establishing that relationship with young people across America and making sure that young people know that you understand what they're dealing with. See, I talk to people all the time worldwide, just to inform everybody that, see, addressing the issue of gun violence, especially in some of the African-American communities, Latino communities, and even some of the white communities. See, in the Black community, it's more of a cultural and tribal situation. So if you do not address the cultural issue when it comes down to gun violence in Black America, so to speak, it will be hard for anybody to really penetrate the mindset because it's cultural and tribal, and a lot of people have been conditioned. For example, a lot of people are on 10 already. When you look at an anger scale from 1 to 10, a lot of people are already on 9 or 10. So if you bump into me, if you say the wrong thing to me, it would make me go off on you and it might make me want to hurt you because I'm already on 9 or 10 due to my own personal frustrations. And the concrete jungle culture dictates. And when I say concrete jungle for your listeners, what I mean is that some of these urban areas where you have a lot of gun violence, it dictates you have to hurt somebody before you get hurt. You know, in other words, young people feel like this. They would rather get caught with a gun than get caught without the gun because of the mindset and the way some people think in some of the urban areas.
You talk about anger and stress being at 9 or 10s. And, you know, it seems that there are multiple theories and perceptions on the pandemic and whether there is a correlation. But what is your take on how the pandemic has affected violent crime?
Well, the pandemic, you know, gun violence has been around way before the pandemic hit.
Sure.
I do believe that maybe 10% of the increase in gun violence nationwide is attributed to the pandemic due to a lot of the stress associated with, you know, the lockdown, the initial lockdown, resources being, taken out of communities. And some of the communities are already economically distressed communities. So, yeah, I believe the pandemic and then the uncertainty with the pandemic and some people are using the pandemic as an excuse to do what they would like to do anyway. It's sort of like in some cities, like in Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Detroit, you know, Memphis, St. Louis, you have even Milwaukee, Wisconsin there. Some guys, especially in Chicago, it seems like it's the purge or something going on. You got young guys driving around in cars with hoods on, you know, on their, you know, a mask on their face and hoodies on, and they have these semi-automatic weapons, and they're out there just shooting. Carjacking's on the rise, and I don't want to paint a picture like it's just so chaotic, but it's kind of rough right now for sure. So some people are using the pandemic as a disguise or as a rationale to do what they already wanted to do, in other words. So it has about 10% of the, I can contribute 10% of the violence, in the increase in violence to the pandemic, without a doubt.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Teo Hardeman, who is executive director of Violence Interrupters. He created an anti-violence initiative. It's been used in more than a dozen cities to train community members to mediate conflicts and to prevent violence before it becomes deadly. You can join in. Why do you think there's been an increase in violence across the country over the last year? What do you think would help stop the cycle? Join in, 800-642-1234. Teo, your group recently worked through a tense situation in Kenosha. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, first and foremost, I want to correct my language, too. Earlier I said contribute. I want to say attribute about 10% of the increase in gun violence to the pandemic. But yes, in Kenosha, we have a strong team. There's the core, it's called, they call themselves the core team in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And the team is headed up by a young man by the name of Minister Khalif in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So we have a great relationship with the police chief, Chief Larson, in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And what happened there was a standoff with some young guys in the Kenosha area. Guns were out and everything. And when the police and the guys that had their guns out, it was a real tense situation because somebody had lost their life and these guys did not want to let go. So when the violence interrupters did arrive, the police actually allowed the violence interrupters to step in and defuse the situation. So the police, they left the scene and the violence interrupters calmed everything down, which I think is so important for everybody in the world to understand. Violence interrupters, we don't just mediate conflicts, you know, on the streets. We also de-escalate tensions with the police and the community at large. And I would like to salute Chief Larson there in Kenosha because he allowed some of his officers to attend a 40-hour violence interrupter training. So we all get to kind of know one another. And that's very important. So that's what happened in the situation there in Kenosha. Because, you know, after Jacob Blake was shot, Kenosha was about to, it kind of erupted, actually. It erupted for a while. And now we're working on trying to, you know, build the relationship and make things a little bit better for, you know, the community and the police in Kenosha, Wisconsin right now.
Jacob Blake shot in the back multiple times, and that anniversary coming up later this month. I want to ask you about the relationship you have with police. How does that work? And how do you also become, you know, build that trust with police officers that you can do this work, you can interrupt the violence?
Well, like I say, it's all about relationships. The main way to interrupt violence and stop somebody from hurting or taking a life is it's all about personal relationships. Our relationship with the police is basically twofold. We do not share information with the police, and they're okay with that. Most of the police know what's going on in the community anyway, so the violence interrupters do not have to play the role as somebody that's going to share a lot of information. What we do, we look to the police to provide us with shooting and homicide data so we can look at the numbers and track the progress of our intervention program, which is very important. Plus, our program is a public health model. So I want to make that clear as well. So also, we work with the police when we organize rallies, marches against violence. The police will come out and patrol the scene. And then we may attend monthly meetings with the police just to kind of take a look and see if the program is working and what more can be done in certain hotspot areas. Which, and then the police, like say Chief Larson and police across the nation, they pretty much work with us and they understand we have to stay in our lane and the police stay in their lane. Our job is to stop a person from crossing the line. And with the police, their job, if a person crosses the line, that's when the police get involved. But that's the intersection there with us in our relationship with the police, which I think is working quite well because right now we have monthly meetings in Kenosha with the police department. And we continue to work on, put it like this, repairing any harm that was caused by the Jacob Blake, you know, incident. And, just continue to just do good work on a higher level. And the police chief, once again, is really supporting the work that we're doing there in Kenosha.
Teo Hardeman, he has dedicated his life work to community organizing for peace and social change. He leads a nonprofit called Violence Interrupters. Have you heard of this violence interruption work where community members are trained to defuse dangerous situations before they become deadly? What do you think of it? What would you say is causing an increase in violence across the country? And what will help stop the cycle? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Teo Hardeman here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the violence interrupters model that has been replicated in more than a dozen cities nationwide. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, as we've been talking about, leaders in Kenosha launched the interrupters model through the Kenosha Coalition Organizing Resolution. And according to the Kenosha News, the group grew out of the social justice protests, the meetings in the wake of the Jacob Blake shooting a year ago this month. What ideas do you have for how to combat violence and crime in vulnerable neighborhoods? Have you worked as an interrupter or done coalition building? Share with us, 800-642-1234. Teo Hardeman leads the nonprofit in the Chicago area called Violence Interrupters and stays with us. Let's bring in Andrew now in Sullivan. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead with your question.
Hi there. So I was just wondering for your guest, how much of an increase in violence do you think can be attributed to defunding the police in certain urban areas? And being as it sounds like you have a good relationship with the police, at least from the Kenosha situation, would you be in favor of having the same police presence in urban areas that's currently there, or would you prefer to see it increase?
Andrew, thank you. Teo.
That's a good question. First of all, I'm not in favor of defunding the police. Don't get me wrong, in Chicago, the police, the budget is around $1.6 billion, and perhaps maybe some of the funding, let's say about 10% of the police budget could be used, to help support mental health services, to help support wraparound services. But at the same time, see, this is the issue with the police. Let me be straightforward with you. See, the police have not been trained to stop killings on the front end. The police have been trained to get involved once a person breaks the law or commits a crime. That's the elephant in the room when it comes down to the police department. So we have to be very mindful of the fact that there's a need for more cultural sensitivity training with police departments across the nation. So, working with the police is okay, but like I say, we all have to just stay in our lane. That's what's most important. Let me just tell your listeners a quick story. About 2 weeks ago in Chicago, I received a phone call where a young guy was trying to rob another guy, and the guy shot him in the leg because he was attempting to run after he tried to rob the guy. And the reason the guy didn't take the guy's life is because he knew the guy's family. The guy had a mask on, but his mask kind of slipped some kind of way. And the guy that he was trying to rob found out who he was. So the guy that got shot ran and told his family members that the guy shot him for nothing. So now it's going to turn into a real bloodbath. So I received a phone call, and I got a chance to go talk to both sides. Then I brought both sides together, and the truth came out. And that's how we mediate conflicts. I don't have time to tell you the entire story because it took about 2 to 3 days to resolve this conflict altogether. But that's just an idea how we save lives on the front end, because this particular conflict could have turned very deadly because the guys' relatives, they were some pretty rough guys as well. So just to give you an idea how we work, with the people in the community, and we establish that trust, and we work it out. My violence interrupters, so far we've mediated around 40 conflicts in Chicago on the front end that could have turned deadly. We stopped somebody from taking a life on the front end, okay? So I'm not in favor of defunding the police entirely, but I will say, look at Minneapolis. They work to defund the police, but there's been an increase in gun violence. So we have to take a look at the bigger picture and try to secure more funding on the federal, state, city level to fund programs, like violence interrupters. And there are a lot of other programs out there as well that do good work also.
How do you convince people, Teo, that they should try mediation instead of turning to a gun when they have never tried to mediate in the past?
Well, that's a good question, too. So this is what it comes down to. Personal relationships, that's how you convince people. See, I cannot talk on this here during this interview the way I talk to the brothers on the streets, because I have to join their world and then bring them into my world. So there's a certain technique we use, and I have a 40-hour training that I facilitate for new violence interrupters, and we train them on one-on-one mediation, restorative justice practices and techniques, the do's and don'ts of gang mediation. So there are ways that you can convince people. For example, there was another guy, I could tell you, I like telling stories because I have all these mediation stories. I'll make it quick.
Please, no, please do. We appreciate your stories. Go ahead.
Okay, good. There was a guy that was about to take the life of another guy over a female. But this guy who was about to take this guy's life, he had served 20 years for murder once before. So he was in front of the lady's house. The other guy was in the house. But the guy that wanted to shoot the guy had a girl at home with three kids. So then when you ask me how do I convince people, when I arrived on the scene, I had to use a lot of profanity to talk this guy down and let him know, man, you got a girl at home. This is a lady you messing with on the side. And the other guy she's with, that's another guy she's messing with. So what are you thinking, man? You got to be kidding me. You know, you got to really get in their face. You have to be kidding me, man. You want to take this guy's life. So I talked to this guy. It took me some hours to convince him to go and take his gun back, put his gun up, go home, put the gun up. Then he came back, said he wanted to fight the guy. I said, I'm not going to let you fight him either, man. You know, I've been knowing you for a while. You got to let this one go, bro. Chalk it up to experience. You know, you got a girl. Your grandmother's at home. She raised you, and she's sick right now. She has an oxygen tank. She's sick. She's going through some health issues. And if you take this guy's life and you go back to jail, your kids won't have a father. You know, your grandmother's sick. Give me a break. So that's the way I had to make a breakthrough in this guy's mindset, to be honest with you. So I really appreciate that question. But that's one of the examples on how you convince people not to take a life and mediate the conflict, okay?
And what I'm hearing is also code switching, right? I mean, confronting people where they are at through the language that they may also know and the honesty that they would trust from you.
Yes. And there you go. It's all about the trust with that individual. And personal relationships, you cannot get around. The reason I keep stressing personal relationships, you cannot get around it. Even some police that have personal relationships with guys on the streets, those relationships are like, those are solid relationships. So that's what it's all about. Because people will listen to people they know and trust. Mm-hmm. And I'm like a big brother or uncle figure to a lot of these young guys. And I don't go too deep with them unless I have to, but I always keep I always keep what they call my ghetto card in my back pocket. I'm also an adjunct professor in the field of restorative justice. I teach as well, and I have a master's degree in inner city studies, but I keep my ghetto card in my back pocket because as a violence interrupter, you have to talk the language of the people.
Okay. We're with T.O. Hardiman, Executive Director for Violence Interrupters. It's based in Chicago. You can join in on gun violence and what you see in your community, 800-642-1234. T.O., as you recruit violence interrupters, the people out there doing the work in neighborhoods, how do you know that someone will be effective? And is it safe for anyone to do this kind of intervention?
For anyone to do this kind of work because.
T.O., I think we just.
I'm here. I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah. We lost your line there for a moment.
It's very important to have street credibility. We look for people that have, believe it or not, some people that have had a past are involved in the street life where they have like a relationship with a lot of guys that's still out there involved in the street life right today. But we have to vet the individuals and make sure that they've given up the street type of lifestyle. But it's also important just to recruit and identify individuals with backbone and the fortitude and the passion to do the work. That's where the training comes in, because you cannot train the wrong people. You have to train the right people to do this kind of work. Just because you ran the streets doesn't mean you can do this kind of work, because I've been in a situation where guys threatened. I had one situation, a guy told me to put me to sleep in my pursuit to save another young man's life. The guy was so mad at me, he told me he would put me to sleep. And how do you deal with them situations? I'm here to tell the story. He did not put me to sleep. But in reality, this is serious work. And I tell people all the time, when you interview people, if they cannot tell you the last time they stopped a killing, some people just out here talking just to talk to sound good. This is a nitty gritty work out here. So we recruit people from the community and we find out who has the relationship with the young guys out there on the streets right now. That's how we recruit individuals for the violence interrupter positions.
How do you measure success, T.O.? How do you know you're making a difference in this epidemic?
What we do is we monitor everything we've done. There's a timeline. For example, when we implement the violence interrupter program, we take a look at the homicide and shootings the previous year and the year before then, and we measure the success by calculating our mediations, the support services, how many people we work with, the high-risk individuals we work with. Then we look at the facts. For example, when I was running ceasefire some years ago, we charted that we work with over 1,200 high-risk youth. We spent 22,000 man hours with those young people, conducted over 1,200 home visits. Then we looked at the fact that the community, you've had a 30% reduction in shootings and homicides compared to the last year or the year before then. That's how we measure the success, based on all of the inputs that we enter into our system, finds the work that we do with the young people. So that, like I said, it's more than just street outreach. It's a public health model that we implement in communities, and we track everything that we do and document it.
Tio, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate you all having me on. One last thing. My website is violenceinterrupters.org. That's violenceinterrupters.org.
Tio, thanks. Tio Hardiman, executive director of the Chicago-based nonprofit called Violence Interrupters. Coming up, we continue the conversation about gun violence and what can be done with lessons from Atlanta and Milwaukee. What questions do you have about anti-violence efforts? 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next here in the Ideas Network. We're discussing gun violence and how to prevent more deaths. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The stats, they're staggering. According to the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, 316 people are shot every day in our country. 106 die. As for children and teens, 22 are gunshot victims every day in our nation. What role does the federal government have in violence prevention? What do you want legislatively? Join in 800-642-1234. Natalie Kaiser is a senior associate with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. She leads the neighborhood transformation efforts at the Atlanta Civic Site. That's one of the communities where the foundation has hometown ties and introduces strategies. Natalie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Good morning. We also have Reggie Moore with us, Director of Violence Prevention Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. Previously, Reggie led injury and violence prevention for the City of Milwaukee Health Department. Reggie, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, Reggie, let's start with you and what you see going on in Milwaukee, a historically violent year. What is driving that?
Right. There's several factors that we've tracked over the past 5 years in the city related to violence. And prior to 2020, we actually achieved a 4-year decline in homicides. 2020, I think, was a new low, not only for Milwaukee, but the country, where we saw historic levels of homicides and non-fatal shootings in our city. And unfortunately, that drumbeat is continuing. We believe that the pandemic and the impact of the pandemic as it relates to unemployment insecurity, as well as housing, as well as the impact on mental health and the stress that is put on families that were already suffering under high rates of poverty, disadvantage, and divestment, as well as high rates of gun violence.
Natalie, do you hear echoes of what Reggie has to say about Milwaukee in what is happening in Atlanta?
Yes, we've seen, sadly, the same uptick in gun violence in Atlanta. And agreed, the similar causes that that Reggie noted. We know that trauma contributes to an uptick in gun violence. Research shows that. And this has definitely been a very traumatic period for many families, especially those who are already living on the margins.
Natalie, you're using a Cure Violence program. What are you doing with this initiative?
So we recently released a report. I think that's part of the reason we were invited to participate today. It's called Improving Community Safety Strategies, and it talks about both the investments we've been making in Atlanta and Milwaukee that Reggie was referring to in his work. And we approach gun violence from a public health perspective, and it's about really looking at those root causes that you were discussing, looking at the data, examining what's contributing to the violence, and doing that with community members who can participate and do the qualitative analysis about what really is going on behind the data. and then identifying what are the effective solutions that match those causes. And in Atlanta, residents identified that while we had things that were contributing to early prevention, we didn't have solutions that were really interrupting the violence and promoting community-wide healing. And so those are the areas that we have been investing in Atlanta. So things that are intervention and treatment oriented were the gaps in the neighborhoods that we're focused on.
Reggie, what are you seeing in Milwaukee of solutions that do promote healing? Reggie, are you there? I think we just... we can hear you. Yes, go ahead.
In 2017, we launched our Blueprint for Peace, which is the city's first comprehensive public health violence prevention plan that was informed by thousands of residents, including young people, who really began to reimagine public safety before that became sort of a buzzword that we've heard around the country. And it really is around looking at what do communities, including young people, families, and neighborhoods need as it pertains to producing safety and well-being. We can't just measure safety by the absence of violence. It also has to be the presence of healing and opportunity. And so I'm glad we're headed in this direction in this conversation, because we understand when we look at, on average, our city has over 300 gunshot survivors a year. That's a lot of individuals, families, coworkers, peers who are impacted by that violence. And so we have to understand that healing is a core element of prevention in order to break the cycle of violence that we're seeing. And so the Blueprint for Peace has 6 goals and 30 strategies that were prioritized by the community to, again, address everything from youth engagement to mental health and restorative justice to improving the capacity and coordination of violence prevention efforts in the city.
Well, those 6 goals and 30 strategies certainly couldn't predict a global pandemic. Has this work been upended, or do you still seeing the progress on these goals?
Definitely. I think one of the things that we're proudest of as a city is the fact that this has become a movement. I think prior to 2016, there was an over-reliance on the criminal justice system as it pertains to public safety. And now that people understand that violence is a public health issue and that everyone has a role to play in making this city safer and stronger, not only has the conversation changed, but the level of engagement where residents are taking ownership of their block, looking out for each other. We saw that even through the pandemic where people were opening up, food pantries and other resources to look out for their neighbors, because we know that when you think about what a safe community looks like, it really is about, number one, people having the things that they need to not only survive but thrive, but then also having connection to neighbors and folks who care about them.
What I'm hearing, Natalie, is that these wraparound services, if you will, are so vital in a neighborhood.
Yes, that is absolutely true. In terms of healing, something that community residents in the areas we're focused on selected to do was to have regular healing circles in the community where they could gather and provide each other peer support to address past trauma, and also to activate a trauma response network. So when a gun violence incident does occur, they can, as you said, wrap around the people who are impacted, which is not just the immediate victim, but the people who knew them, the people who saw the incident, the businesses nearby, to reach out to those people and see what kind of support and services they might need that they could be connected with by the trauma response network. And both of those are driven by community residents who are trained and participate in those.
We're talking with Natalie Kaiser, who leads the neighborhood transformation efforts at the Atlanta Civic Site. Reggie Moore is with us, Director of Violence Prevention Policy for the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts on gun violence and what you see happening at your community level. 800-642-1234. Chris is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, we have to get to the base. We have to get to prevention. And I'm thinking back in my career as a longtime teacher when, and even farther than that, when I was about 14, I went to a movie And it was the first Frankenstein horror movie. And I laughed with everyone else. And then I went back home to the farm. And the next night, I rode my pony. I loved to ride it down on a road near the marsh and see the mist. And I loved it. It was romantic and beautiful. All of a sudden, I didn't see the beauty. I saw these monstrous hands coming out. And I rode the pony back home. And as I tell this story, I get a chill up and down my back. That was about 65 years ago.
So the images that you saw really stay with you, that really haunt you. And I want to take this back to Reggie here for a moment and getting to the root of the problem, but also the images portrayed in media, in films, and what impact does that have?
I'm glad that he mentioned that story, because I want to translate that into what's happening on the streets of our city and cities around the country, where we had an incident in the city where over 300 shots were fired in the air. Two people ended up being injured in that incident. But those shots were heard for at least 8 blocks around that area. And it was a shopping area parking lot that was vacant. And the impact of just hearing gunshots on a regular basis, research has shown that that has an impact on school performance among young people. So then take that to imagining seeing a friend being shot or knowing people who have been killed or injured as a result of gun violence, and understanding that that has an impact on not only the mental health and psychological well-being of a person, or can have, but also creates a sense of fear that, oh my God, everyone has a gun and everyone is using a gun. And there was research done by the Joyce Foundation in Chicago that found when they surveyed young people who carried firearms, 98% of them were carrying them out of fear for their safety. And so even though homicide, we had a 4-year reduction in homicides in the city, the perception of violence outweighed that. And so obviously I'm at a medical college and an institution that cares a lot about data and research. And so we have to translate and understand that data is a very important piece, but we also have to change the reality on the street, because these things stay with people for a very long time. And I think his story is an example of that.
Natalie, your thoughts there on perception, on trauma that stays.
Well, I totally agree. And I really appreciate both the story as well as the research, that if you view or are impacted by a gun violence incident, that stays with you. The research shows that. And so, but I think it's also just important to note that it's not inevitable that you will have like post-traumatic stress, or that you will have accelerated, aggression due to viewing these kinds of things, that you can heal, and that it's important for us to use solutions that are promising, solutions that have evidence behind them, to help people heal so that we can move forward as communities holistically. And I think we have to also recognize that that many communities have experienced, oppression historically, and that historic oppression is a kind of long-term trauma that also needs to be addressed, and people need the opportunity to heal from.
Natalie Kaiser is with the Anna E. Casey Foundation at its Atlanta Civic Site. Reggie Moore works on violence prevention at the Medical College of Wisconsin. How do you stop the cycle of deadly gun violence? How effective is it to reach out to victims and perpetrators of violence after an incident? Do you think the harm done can be repaired? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Cities around the country have seen a spike in killings. It's part of an overall trend of rising violent crime. It's caused police and community groups to scramble, trying to stop the cycle or interrupt it, as we talked about earlier. President Biden had ordered federal strike forces to help catch gun traffickers who are supplying weapons used in the shootings. What intervention will work? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Reggie Moore directs violence prevention policy at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And Natalie Kaiser is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation in Atlanta, focused on neighborhood transformation. They're with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Nancy now in Hartford. Nancy, your thoughts.
College of Wisconsin.
I'm curious to know if there are any plans for incorporating safety classes into school curriculums or classes on oppression.
Yeah, safety classes in school curriculums or starting at the student level. Reggie, you first.
That's something that's been talked about at the community level. I'm not sure in terms of how far that's reached into at the state level with DPI or at the local school district level. But in the community, there's definitely been conversation and even organizations that have offered safety classes. I know with the Office of Violence Prevention, they actually developed a campaign to educate folks about some of the myths and facts around gun safety. And the consequences of, you know, for example, straw purchases and those types of things. So it's extremely important understanding that we had a 300% increase in gun purchases in 2020. There are a lot of firearms in homes and in our neighborhoods, and it's important. We can't ignore that element in terms of gun safety.
Milwaukee police are recovering thousands of guns each year. Reggie, will that make any difference? What do you think about efforts to get guns off the streets, out of people's hands?
Given the amount of firearms that, again, are already in the community, individuals who are prohibited from having firearms, we definitely want to get those, you know, off the street. But we also have to balance that understanding that people need to store firearms safely and use them, you know, and be responsible, because we've also seen incidents where children have gotten access to those firearms and harmed themselves, peers, and even their parents. And so gun safety is also critically important.
Natalie, your thoughts on school curriculum, what can be done at the school level?
So we've seen promising practices in terms of conflict mediation interventions and restorative justice work. Those are not something that we're specifically working on at this moment, but I have seen promising efforts in that regard in Atlanta.
Reggie, you work at the Medical College of Wisconsin, reviewing policy changes, making policy recommendations. How does that factor into this?
It's critically important. We know that there are things like universal background checks and emergency risk protection orders that can have an impact on reducing violence, and even including suicides. And so those are things that we support and things that we advocate for in partnership with groups like the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, as well as the Brady for Gun Safety. So policy is a critical element and a critical public health strategy. So in addition to, education and outreach, intervention programs, we also have to change policy at a local, state, and federal level.
Natalie, what do you say to people who may think, this isn't in my neighborhood, gun violence doesn't affect me, it is in someone else's community, it's over there, and I can walk away from this and not think about it. What would you tell those types of people?
I think gun violence affects all of us because, as was referenced, children and families can't really pursue their full potential. And so they can't contribute fully to our society if they're not able to achieve their full potential because safety issues are preventing them from, attending school regularly, from being able to show up for their job, from being able to, pursue a business. So that stifles our society. So it affects all of us. I think it's important to note that gun violence is the leading cause of death for young Black men. So it has a very particular impact on young Black men. And it's not, gun violence prevention is not receiving the level of investment that you see for other leading causes of death. And I think, we need to interrogate that. But it affects all of us, and we need to be investing in prevention.
Certainly the data is so critical there. I want to circle back to trauma response and the notion that if you can help people through the trauma, that that will help solve the problem. How do you see trauma as being an effective tool as you look at this really multifaceted, complex problem, Natalie?
So, I mean, I don't think it's healing that is the tool. You know, what are the mechanisms we can put in place to help people heal? And that can include community residents being trained themselves on how to help each other heal, to be being trained on the biological impacts of trauma and what can be done to tamp those down and help people have their own tools for being resilient. So I think there, and of course, you know, having better access to mental health supports, there's a lot of stigma around mental health. So doing community education to help people, you know, feel that mental health is a pathway for them is important, and making sure that it is, you know, accessible and affordable and available for people when they need it is important as well.
Let's bring in Joe in Madison. Joe, hi.
Hi, thank you. To me, it's all about how we raise boys. Boys are brought up alone, lonely. They're bullied and not protected by adults. They grow up frightened and wanting revenge. And they see when they see, you know, all the adults with like the United States government with a bloated military, that guns and weapons are the right way to respond to everything, and that the bigger gun, the safer you are, which is of course ludicrous. But it's all about how we raise boys.
Reggie, let's get Reggie to respond.
No, I couldn't agree more. When we look at the, you know, who's on both sides of the firearm, gun violence disproportionately impacts men, and as Natalie mentioned, African-American men in particular. And so understanding on a primary prevention side, you know, there are promising programs that we see around the country, like Becoming a Man in Chicago, Be the Change in Milwaukee with Running Rebels, Rites of Passage programs, all have a powerful impact in, again, reshaping the negative conditioning that we get as boys in this country around what does it mean to be a man, and the only acceptable emotion to be expressed is anger. And so we're carrying around a lot of sadness, a lot of pain, and with nowhere to process that or share that because, again, we've received all of these negative and missed messages about what does it mean in our humanity.
Reggie, in the last few moments we have, what can we do at the individual level to help stop the violence? What would you tell people?
Given the statewide reach of this program, I want to address it on two levels. So on the individual level, again, I think we have to do everything possible to ensure that young people, families, and neighborhoods have what they need to thrive. We have to invest in primary prevention programs, whether that's after-school programming, quality schools, all of those investments. I think we will see the outcome of that on an individual and a collective level. However, I also want to address on a statewide level with ARPA funding, we have an opportunity for the governor to invest that funding in establishing a statewide Office of Violence Prevention and funding these programs around the state. And we would love to see that.
Thank you both for joining us. Reggie Moore there, Director of Violence Prevention Policy for the Medical College of Wisconsin, which for disclosure is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Natalie Kaiser leads neighborhood transformation at the Annie A. Casey Foundation's Atlanta Civic Site. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.